So this is February 9th, 2011. I'm Rick Hansen, and tonight I want to talk about don't be alarmed and situate that in a larger context. So as you've heard, I think from Linda and the other guest teachers we've had, and maybe a little bit of me setting up this year, I hope this year to really explore relationships as a field of practice, practice being what we do as we heal and deepen in our well-being, contribute more to others and the whole wide world, and move progressively in our own way on our own path of awakening. Who knows, maybe all the way, you know, to complete liberation from suffering and harm. So as we do that, you know, relationships are really important, right? It's where a lot of our greatest sorrows are and a lot of our greatest joys and greatest challenges to step out of and let go of various kinds of contraction and pressing and negative emotional reactions and so forth. I mean negative not morally, I mean negative pragmatically, you know, what causes suffering or harm. Relationships are also a great supportive practice, right? It's not an accident that, you know, the Buddha famously said to Ananda, his cousin and primary attendant, that community, in one sense, is the whole of the holy life, because it's so fundamental in supporting us even when we're doing various kinds of solitary or secluded practice. That said, last year we were going to work our way through the four, count them, four foundations of mindfulness, and we got through three. All right, that leaves one left, so I thought of using the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which I'll describe in a moment, as a way also into relationships. So that's kind of what we're doing for a little bit longer, and then we're just going to really go freewheeling into the world of relationships, or what Jean-Paul Sartre called the hell that is other people. So, for tonight, what is the fourth foundation of mindfulness consist of? So if you'll forgive a bit of repetition, essentially it consists of a series of lists that have to do with the primary factors or some of the most important factors in Buddhism, factors leading to suffering or its end. And the fourth foundation consists of various places, loosely defined, of our experience, various aspects of experience where these factors play out. So specifically, the fourth foundation of mindfulness means resting attention, resting awareness in various places. So one place are the five hindrances, all right, which include greed, broadly defined, hatred, broadly defined, sloth and torpor, which means basically just kind of sitting on your tush in various ways. Let's see, doubt, major hindrance, and also restlessness or remorse. So that's those are the hindrances. Another one of the lists, there are five lists basically in the fourth foundation of mindfulness, are the five aggregates. The idea that all of experience boils down to these five things. The first is form, which means all of material reality plus our bare apprehension or sensation of it. And then the feeling tone of pleasant and pleasant or neutral. Third, among the five aggregates, is perception or memory, labeling what's there. Fourth, is everything else flowing through the mind. And fifth is consciousness. Those are the five aggregates. Okay. Then we have the six sense spheres. This is pretty familiar. What, sight, sound, seeing, hearing, tasting, feeling, and smelling, and the internal world. That's considered a sense sphere in Buddhism. All right. It's complicated enough already, and we have two more to go. You know, the fourth group, is the seven factors of awakening. Now we're having some fun, right? Finally some good news. What are the seven factors of awakening? These are really worth knowing. And we'll use them later tonight. They include mindfulness, investigation, energy, bliss, that sounds pretty good, tranquility, concentration, which is a technical term, which means very deep absorption, and equanimity, non-reactivity. Right? And then last, we have the Four Noble Truths, you know, the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the ending of the cause of suffering and the truth of the path leading to that end. Okay? It's a lot of material, isn't it? What's it really about? Right? What are those things really about? Basically, it's about how to, as the Buddha said, you know, how to suffer less, including all the way to complete freedom of suffering. And what comes forward when we suffer less? What comes forward when we're free from suffering? Is it just a big numbness, a big void, a big blah, a big blank? Actually, no. It's the highest happiness, he said, which is peace. We're engaged with the world. We have sensations. We have a nervous system that keeps running. We have, you know, a bladder that keeps working until it doesn't. You know, all kinds of things keep going, right? But along that way, we're increasingly free, increasingly open, increasingly present, increasingly untroubled by the waves that keep moving through us of daily life. All right. So how do we do it? Well, running through those various factors that lead to the end of suffering is a general theme of what's called in Latin as a tradition, as a term, the via negativa. What in the world does that mean? The via negativa defines virtue or practice as what you drop. In other words, what you don't do. Right? It's the way of ending. It's the way of abandoning. It's the way of uprooting. In other words, the notion is that if you prune away the dead stuff or the problematic stuff, what's left is really great, and that's all you have to do. Right? It's interesting how much of the Dharma in Buddhism is expressed in that way. Not. Like, think of the five precepts, right? Not killing, not stealing, not intoxicating, not sexing in harmful ways, and not lying. Right? What are so many of the things we're supposed to do? We're supposed to, you know, release the poison of greed, release the poison of hatred, release the poison of ignorance or delusion. Right? It's a kind of a dropping, a shedding. That's good news, in a sense, because it's a lot easier to sort of drop something than it is to build something from scratch. You know? It's a lot easier to lop off a dead limb or an infected limb of a tree than it is to grow the whole tree. But this only works if something wonderful remains when all that other stuff is pruned away. And embedded in that view, and something that's very important for us, I think, to open to and resort to as a refuge and a fuel on this long, you know, path of a human life, is the notion that when we drop what's problematic, when we drop what's suffering, when we drop what's harmful, what remains is beautiful. What remains is awareness. What remains is happiness. What remains is a sense of security, no matter what's going on. What remains is love. You know, the awakened heart is what remains. Who knows? Maybe what we're doing is we're uncovering the divine transcendental that's always been already present, right? Or alternately, we're simply opening out into the natural state of the nervous system and mind, you know, to the nth degree, characterized by a quality of joy and love and peace. Don't know. But it is clear that as, you know, as the sediments in the pond slowly settle out in the mind, what remains is beautiful, clear water. In terms of that via negativa, what might be one of the most important things to drop? And I want to suggest tonight that one of the most important things to drop is a quality of alarm, or in particular, getting alarmed that there's an alarm. All right? And let me explain, if I could, what I mean by that. So in life, and certainly in our relationships, we encounter various kinds of alarms. Right? I'll offer a few to you and see if you can help me out here by suggesting a few more. I mean, a letter from the IRS. a late night call from a teenager, a report card for your fifth grader sometimes, a funny sensation or bump in your own body, a frown across a dinner table, someone disagreeing, walking through an airport, threat level orange, right? How about you? What are some of the everyday alarms in daily life?
Seeing the red light of the highway patrol.
Oh yeah, that's an archetypal alarm, the twirling lights behind you. I was walking in the hills above Terra Linda earlier today, getting a little overdue aerobic exercise, and I saw two puffs of smoke coming up from the forest in the distance. Now, that was a little alarming. I called 911. It was a test fire, and that's okay, but that's an alarm. Any other examples of alarm? Yeah.
The headlines in the newspapers, any paper you pick up, something that grabs your attention.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. A couple others? Yeah.
I think an earthquake, and then also anything technical.
Right. Right. If your computer started, my computer recently, I'd turn it on, it would make a repetitive, like, beep, 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 pause. You know, that was fairly alarming. It all turned out okay, though, but still. Okay, so you can see these are gross alarms. Think about things in relationships. For example, any kind of anger is very alarming to us as social animals. You know, studies show that among primates, the signal that's most salient, everybody in the troop or the band stops to what is going on there, you know, to get a sense of what's going on there, because anger is very alarming. Other signals socially include fear or disgust, very primary. We really track signals, facial expressions of fear or disgust from people around us. Those are alarming. What if somebody doesn't see it your way? A violation of like-mindedness. How terrible, you know, right? Like, I was talking last night with our son, about different kinds of college things. And I mentioned in passing Saybrook, which does external degrees. I'm actually a trustee. And, you know, Jan said something kind of a little disparaging about Saybrook in terms of whether, because it's non-residential or something. And I was like, what? You know, she didn't agree with me. That was alarming in some way. What? Right? Okay. What if someone is accusing you of something or criticizing you? You know, it's really easy to empathize with people when they share their experience and their upsets and their problems, as long as it's not about you, right? But if you're the one that they're bothered by, suddenly that's pretty alarming, isn't it? I mean alarm kind of loosely, but it gets us going. It's a signal of trouble coming. It jacks us up, right? The same systems kick into gear when there's a frown across the dinner table or a red light behind our car that kicked into gear millions of years ago to get us to accelerate and rev up and redline in order to survive, you know, an attacking lion. Okay. So that's the gross stuff. But there's a lot of little stuff, because to survive, we have to do three things that are impossible. Okay? And every time we fail at them, which is all day long, alarm bells just ripple out through the whole body mind. So what are those three things? So to survive, one thing we have to do is we have to separate from the world. We have to have a kind of a boundary. You know, I'm here, the world is there. All organisms have to do that. Second thing we have to do is we have to stabilize all kinds of equilibria. In other words, all kinds of sort of balances at many, many levels of the body. You know, the amount of oxygen in the blood, flows of hormones, metabolism of various chemicals that become, you know, neurotransmitters and all the rest of that. We have to manage equilibria at higher and higher levels that start moving into conscious awareness in terms of how we feel moment to moment, or the balance, you know, of power with other people. So the brain is constantly trying, the whole body is constantly trying to keep things steady within a good range. But because of the fact of impermanence, everything is constantly being disturbed, right? And the third thing we have to do to survive is we have to attain pleasure and avoid pain, right? Those are the three goals, right? Separate from the world, maintain stability, and attain pleasure, avoid pain. How's that working for you, as Dr. Phil said, or me? Well, the problem is boundaries are continually crossed in terms of separation from the world because we have to metabolize at the most basic bodily level. You know, we're interdependent with the world. And interpersonally, we're continually exchanging with other people, you know. So right there, continually, is some violation of sort of the self-world boundary. Second, as I said a moment ago, these equilibria are continually disturbed because everything keeps changing. You know, the equilibria move out of range, conditions change, which bonk that equilibrium around. Constantly changing, okay? It's getting disturbed. And then with regard to avoiding pain, you know, as the Buddha pointed out, we've got old age, disease, and death with a lot of mental and physical discomfort along the way. That's absolutely unavoidable. And then in terms of attaining pleasures, first, when you may not get them. Second, when you get them, they're usually not as great as advertised by the mind, or let alone the billboards out there. And third, they end. Can you believe that? You know, as the Buddha said, among the five main reflections he suggested, you know, is it given to you to not be separated one way or another, ultimately, from everything you love? No, it's not. So, that too. So whenever those three things are not able to accomplish their mission, in other words, whenever we're not able to perfectly separate from the world or stabilize equilibria, or attain pleasure and avoid pain, alarm signals get sent out throughout the body. Most of those alarm signals are below the waterline. They're outside of conscious awareness. But they create a background of anxiety, unease, unsettledness, a kind of priming. You know, we're ready to go ballistic. We're always at DEFCON 2. You know, if DEFCON 5 is nuclear war, defense condition, DEFCON, all right? You know, we're always kind of at DEFCON 2 just because of the background in the body. And then what bubbles up into conscious awareness is a kind of background of unease, anxiety, unsettledness that's ready to organize itself around some sense of threat. In the nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, which really manages, you know, moment-to-moment housekeeping, has all these little nodes running throughout the whole body that are like giant microprocessors. They're processing information, most of it outside of awareness, and a lot of what they're processing is kind of background wallpaper in beingness, if you will, is a subtle background sense of alarm. That alarm makes us suffer. That sense of alarm causes us to act badly toward ourselves and other people. It causes us to do things to make it go away, if only for a moment. Let's anesthetize ourselves with, fill in the blank, food, sex, tobacco, drugs, alcohol, TV, fill in the blank. What? Football, baseball, a few other diversions. There's a place for diversion, but we do those things. You know, alarm is really problematic. And then if you live in a time where you're inundated with media that's full of alarm messages, and we also live in a time, and we've always lived in a time, when various groups use the human biological vulnerability to alarm and threat and fear to manipulate people in order to gain or hold on to political power. You know, getting really on top of the alarm game, you know, not being alarmed, is really important. The question is how to do it. I want to use the structure of the seven awakening factors to talk about how to deal with this. And then I think we could do, if you're willing, a conversation with a partner, and then we'll come back and talk about it. Okay? And I encourage you to think about this with regard to relationships. So, in terms of the awakening factors, the first one is mindfulness. That's where we're aware of this very subtle sense of threat, alarm, unease, disturbance. Okay, we're aware of it. We're aware of it as deeply as we can be. You know, we're not aware of it continuously, but we return awareness to it periodically multiple times a day. And at various times, maybe we really open up to an investigation of, wow, why is it so difficult to sustain the sense that I'm actually all right now? It's actually okay. Why is it actually so difficult to relax my guard, to open and soften? What's going on here? What's the machinery, the mechanics of bracing against life, of being vigilant? Right? That's mindfulness. Second part of mindfulness is to be aware of the reactions to the alarm. You know, the term in psychology, signal anxiety. The alarms are the signals, right? But is the signal meaningful? If the truth is, we're pretty much endlessly alarmed as background noise. So we can observe, what are the reactions to the alarm? Second, investigation. That's where we really look into it. What is this about? Is this, do I inherently need to be alarmed because I've completed an exhalation and I haven't yet begun an inhalation? You know, do I actually need to be alarmed sitting here with you and you're looking away from me right now? You interrupted me. Do I actually need to be alarmed by that? Oh, you're not agreeing with me. Do I need to be alarmed by that? There's a little bit of a pain in my body. Do I need to be alarmed by that? Investigation. Third, energy. You know, it really helps to mount some energy to address this and not be passive about it. The energy that says, you know, I don't like having Chicken Little. I don't like having a flock of Chicken Littles in my head, always going, the sky's falling. The sky's falling. I don't like that. I don't like being spooked by threat messages around me that hijack me, that try to hijack, you know, my inner iguana. Right? Every time I walk through an airport. I don't like that. I don't want to live in fear. It's not good for me. It's not good for the people around me. So we arouse energy. We get on our own side. We're for ourselves. Or to bring it into relationships, we basically say, you know, I don't want to feel threatened by you. So I want to talk to you about the stuff you're doing that actually is a little alarming, reasonably so. Right? But I also want to help myself not be alarmed by stuff that's minor, trivial, at most a yellow flag, and actually most of the time it's just it's a green flag. It's okay. Okay, energy. Fourth, bliss. And to me the application of bliss here, or rapture, is this idea that you can take resort in and recall feelings of happiness and joy that are outside of feeling alarmed. In other words, just because there's something mildly problematic or mildly stressful right now, it doesn't need to wash away the happiness I have found in this relationship or the knowing in me that I'm a good person in relationships and it's going to be okay. The knowing in me that I've repaired problems 10,000 times in relationships and, okay, something's come up here, but this is just going to be 10,001. That we fixed something. It's okay. You know, returning to the felt sense of happiness, joy, that just transcends whatever this alarm signal is. It's bigger than this alarm signal. And will last past the time that this alarm signal, whatever it is passed away. And then comes the idea of concentration or samadhi. You know, and there, I think, one can draw on one's experiences, whatever they've been, of some kind of awakening. Everyone in this room has had some kind of awakening moment. Maybe in nature, some kind of deep sense of peace, maybe in meditation, maybe on retreat, maybe in yoga, maybe when your child was born, maybe sometime, one time making love, maybe in church as a kid. Some moment where you got really that all this little stuff is contained in a vast space of wonderfulness. And recollecting that and regrounding in that is a way to not be so swayed by it. I forgot to mention tranquility. I'll mention that one now. Tranquility is actually very relevant as an awakening factor for feeling alarm in that several ones. One, we can preemptively calm the body. I've really taken up a personal practice a lot recently of preemptively calming my body down. And preemptively, I literally visualize, I don't know if you've seen a lizard or held a lizard and stroked its belly. It's all just, you know, like the deepest root of the alarm system is in the, you know, the brainstem and the avoid pain system, which is really grounded in the reptile, fish, insect, crab phase of our life on this planet. So I think about calming the inner iguana, you know, just really stroking its little blue belly, little lizard, it's okay, really, it's all right. And then calming that inner rat, you know, that's more like the limbic system, you know. Little baby rat, you're okay. It's okay, man. Just rat on. It's okay. No worries, little rat. It's all good. And then the monkey caveman, it's okay. By the fire, we can relax. We're in the cave. We're with our buds. Very tranquilizing to call up the felt sense, as Linda very eloquently talks about, of being cared about by other people. In our cave, we're by the fire. It's okay. It's raining out there. I'm warm. I'm dry. You know, I'm with my friends. It's okay. You know. Tranquilizing, calming. Or when those alarm signals come, having them meet a kind of big tranquilizing shock absorber. It's okay. Yeah, let's deal with the real tiger, but let's not be afraid of the paper tigers, the false alarms. Tranquility. And then last awakening factor, and then we'll maybe do a paired thing, is equanimity. Equanimity is where we don't get alarmed that we're alarmed. Tranquility starts turning down the alarm signals. That's great. Tranquility is great. I remember on a retreat with Joseph Goldstein, great Buddhist teacher in America, really stressing the importance of the cultivation of tranquility. And you see tranquility really appearing a lot in the Buddhist teachings. You know, him talking about finding a place of seclusion, or him talking about, in terms of the awakening factors, tranquility, or in terms of the mindfulness of breathing, that we progressively tranquilize the body or tranquilize the breath. You know, we live in a very untranquil culture. People come here to America from other Western industrial democracies, very modern places, and they just shake their heads, you know, and then very often go home because they just think, this is just too hot. It's too revved up, you know. Okay. And then, but equanimity is more profound than tranquility in that it allows these alarm signals to come. And this is where the idea of the inherence, the inevitability of dukkha comes in that there's a certain amount of alarm that will never quiet. It's unpleasant. We can't get around it. In order to live, we need to be alarmed. In order to live, we need to have systems that try to separate us from the world, stabilize things, attain rewards, and avoid punishments. We need to have those systems. And, you know, the animal needs alarm systems that signal departures from those aims, right? We need those. There's no way around it. We're going to be alarmed every day. You know, the question is, can we not be alarmed about being alarmed? Can we no longer consider those alarms as meaningful? Can we increasingly consider the subtle alarming in the body, the subtle anxiety in the body, or the subtle disturbances in the force, in the field, you know, with other people? Can we consider those as meaningless, as just noise, not signal, pure noise? You know, it's like having an alarm bell in a school. It just is continually ringing kind of quietly. It's a little troubling, but we don't need to be troubled by it. Okay. So, yeah, and then let's do a paired thing. So I'll be real quick in my response. It's not officially in there, metta being offering of loving kindness. I think it's kind of woven throughout them, and in particular, I think of metta in this analysis as really promoting a sense of tranquility and safety. Because as we give love, as we give compassion and kindness out, technically that really lights up the same neural circuits that are engaged in receiving it. So love feeds us whether it's given or received. Love broadly defined. Okay. You want to grab a partner? You can always sit this out. And I thought we could do is pick an A and a B and talk about A, and you don't have to do it at this subtle level, but you could do it at a more of a gross level. What do you find alarming? In other words, what do you find anxiety provoking or threatening in a key relationship? Okay? What is troubling or what rattles you? Just think about it basically as a rattle. What makes you feel uneasy? What rattles you in a key relationship? And when it's your turn to talk, because one will mainly talk, one will mainly listen, when it's your turn to talk, try to explore out loud, wow, how could I help myself inside my own mind not be so rattled or frazzled or frightened by that thing that's going on in the relationship? Is the topic clear? So something that's kind of rattling or anxiety provoking in a key relationship, and how could you help yourself be less rattled by it? Okay, so pick an A and a B. A's will go first as talkers. B's mainly listen. Don't give advice if you're the listener. It's okay to ask questions. Okay, A's begin for about 3 or 4 minutes. One more minute.